life.
A podcast of the cinema. The last thing you said before that 3-second gap at the beginning was, I'm ready.
Oh, well, I...
You know, this, sometimes you're more ready than other times when you think you're fully ready.
Yes, indeed.
It's been a harrowing 10 minutes of mic checks and sound equipment malfunctions, but now we're here.
Sure.
And your name is Alonzo Duralde.
Uh-huh.
You're the co-host of this show. You are also the co-host of the Who Shot You podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. You're also the co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast on the Breakfast All Day Network. You are the arts, you're the reviews editor. You're the arts and entertainment.
No.
You're the, of the Cleveland Plain dealer. No. You're the reviews editor at the Wrap. You're married to me.
Dave White.
What's my name?
Dave White.
Say my name.
Dave White. You're a film critic of the Wrap and also co-host of this program.
That's correct.
Yes.
I'm pretty happy we have a guest today.
We do.
Would you like to do the technical thing that you have to do before I introduce the guest?
Sure.
Okay.
We'll do that.
Great.
So now we're back after that bit of equipment, musical chairing. We have a guest today. Now, our guest is a man named Dave Markey. Some of you already know who he is because some of you are people like myself who have paid attention to the specific world that his filmmaking has covered over the years. You have been, Dave, on my wish list of guests for this show for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But there was always, I've always wanted it to be in conjunction with something new that was coming. And when I would hear, you know, oh, there's the 25th anniversary of this or that film that you made, I'd think, that's a great idea. Someone else is already doing a retrospective with him, and I want to wait for something, like, new and happening. So that new and happening thing is Desolation Center. Now, you are a filmmaker, and I'm going to just read through so many of your credits right now. The Slog Movie, Desperate Teenage Love Dolls, Love Dolls Superstar, 1991, The Year Punk Broke, The Reenactors, The Circle Jerks documentary, My Career as a Jerk. You have directed many, many music videos as well for Black Flag, Mudhoney, Meat Puppets, Shaun and Knife, The Black Lips, Bob Mould, and mostly for Sonic Youth, for the videos for Mildred Pierce, for Cinderella's Big Score, for The Diamond Sea, and the one that probably more people have seen than anything else, their cover of The Carpenters' Superstar. Welcome to our show. I'm thrilled that you are here.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I was a fan of your work before I even knew that you had a name. Like, before I knew that, you know, some guy was making these things that I was watching on VHS tape passed around among the 27 punk rock people in Lubbock, Texas. Because that's what would happen. We would get the tapes of, like, Richard Kern movies like Fingered or You Killed Me First or Survival Research Labs tapes or Desperate Teenage Love Dolls. And all that stuff would just get sort of passed from person to person to person. And here's a weird thing. You were also in the bands Sin 34 and Painted Willie. Painted Willie went on tour with Black Flag in 1986. Y'all came to Lubbock, Texas. I was at that show. So it's really strange now that we're neighbors.
Been neighbors for a long time.
Been a long time, too.
And all that all that stuff happened so long ago.
So long ago, yeah.
Back when I was a mere tyke.
Yeah, and we're the same age.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the same time in the 80s, in addition to being in these bands and making these films. You were doing the zine We Got Power, which is now available as a coffee table book. It's just, and it's very cool. And if you care about this sort of thing at all, you should be going out and buying it.
The photo book primarily.
Yeah.
And it does also, it also does include every issue and every page of the zine produced.
Yeah.
From 1981 to 1984.
Yeah. So it's like this, you know, big comprehensive thing. So you are also currently a Talking Head interviewee in Desolation Center. So Desolation Center is a film, a documentary by Stuart Sweezy, and it's slowly rolling its way out around the country this fall. Currently, it's playing in Los Angeles. And what the film is about is the sort of post-hardcore scene in Los Angeles and how, you correct me if I'm getting any facts wrong here, cops drove y'all out to the desert, basically.
Not literally in their vehicles, but the police presence certainly was, I think, one of the main things that got Stuart looking elsewhere to host these shows. Because in that period, in the early 80s in L.A., the LAPD was just infamous for raiding and shutting down all these clubs or shows or what have you in a very kind of violent fashion, I might add. And, you know, Stuart's idea was to bring it out to a place where there'd be no police.
Right.
And,
now how many of these shows, what happened was everyone got on buses and
that was the first
generators show, right. were brought and bands just performed out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. It was very sort of haphazardly put together as, you know, the film sort of depicts, but, yet somehow it worked. And the very first show took place in the middle of the Mojave with the Minutemen and Savage Republic. And how they got everyone there was on rented school buses.
Right.
I did not attend that show. I went to the second desert show, the Gila Monster Jamboree, which was about a year and a half or so later, I believe.
Right.
In January of 85 or February of 85.
Yeah.
Something like that. In the middle of winter in the Mojave Desert.
Yeah, everyone's wearing coats. You can see everyone wearing bundled up in jackets.
It was literally freezing temperatures. And felt really bad for the musicians that actually had to play under those conditions.
Right.
Very not easy to play in cold weather. It's like, but... yeah, and by the time they did that show, though, they opened it up. They allowed you to drive your own vehicles to this undisclosed destination. But you sort of had to find your way there. You went to one point and got a reference map, and then that map took you sort of through all these twists and turns that got you to the actual location of the event. And... in many situations, comedy ensued.
Yeah, there's a funny sequence in the film where Red Cross is trying to get out to this thing, and they just keep getting lost. And there's a woman driving them who they just run out of gas, and they wind up just abandoning the car.
You have to imagine this. It's in the middle of the night. There's no lights. There's these dirt roads. You're told to go up a dirt road for 1.2 miles and then make a left turn on another dirt road. Even a very skilled... back then, of course, there was no such thing as GPS.
No.
There was no cell phones. There was none of the luxuries that we have in present day as far as navigation goes. But, Thomas Brother Guide was pretty much the Bible.
Now, were you at the show that happened on the boat?
I did not attend that one either.
No.
Funny enough, the only one of the three infamous shows I did attend was the Gila Monster Jamboree.
Yeah.
At the time, I was living in the back of a rehearsal/recording studio in North Hollywood on Burbank Boulevard, right near Cahuenga. And I just remember funds were very tight for me. Like $15 to see a show was
a lot.
Unreasonable.
That's a crazy amount of money.
These days, people spend hundreds of dollars to see
right.
the Misfits.
Right.
Back then, I would see the Misfits in Watts playing above a liquor store for $4.50.
Right.
I mean, I mean $4.50, not $450.
Right.
Which I think you could very easily spend to see a band like that at Madison Square Gardens
in 2019. Yeah, what just reminding me, the Minutemen came to Lubbock. And, in fact, they performed in Lubbock about 7 weeks before D. Boone died. And I remember the show. They were doing two shows at this little bar. And it was like a 9 o'clock show and an 11 o'clock show. And everybody I knew had the $10 to go to both shows, to sit through both shows. And I remember thinking, I have five. I can go to the first show because I have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go to work. So I'm going to go to the first show. I don't have money for both shows. So yes, the idea of paying 15 for a show back then would have made it into the, you know, it would have turned it into the realm of a special event,
sure.
which is what this was.
Absolutely.
You know, particularly because, you know, you're having to really go out of your way to get to these places. You're having to go on they say the word field trip in the film, but it feels, and often the footage that I saw, quite often it looks like a terrifying wild goose chase. Like, these are serial killer roads. You know, you could die out there. I spent a good chunk of the film thinking to myself, were they safe?
Like, are we going to run into the Manson?
What if something bad happened? You know, like, and then you add survival research labs to the mix in some of these shows, and you're thinking, someone could really die from their equipment, because these were the guys who, they weren't a band, they were performance, and they set up, like, exploding robots that fought each other and it occasionally attacked the crowd. You know, like, it was that kind of craziness. So the thing about that is that it felt more, as I watched it, because again, you know, being your age but being in a different state and experiencing this culture through the prism of that, you know, geographic distance, meant that, you know, all our eyes were on y'all and what y'all were doing. You know, information traveled very slowly. Mm-hmm. And so, but what was happening here, you had this geographic benefit of being at the epicenter of so much activity. That, you know, as I said, we're watching you guys and taking cues from you guys for our own sort of little towns, making events happen outside of bars and clubs. There was only one bar in Lubbock that would let a punk band play. And
what was the name of the venue?
A Main Street Saloon.
I think that's where we played.
Well,
again in 87 too, when we went out on our own,
yeah.
a long time ago, but it sounds familiar.
At the 86 show, with Black Flag, y'all were at an abandoned warehouse.
Oh, okay.
That was not licensed to be anything. It was, no one was supposed to be in that space.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
A lot of bootleg places just sort of thrown together by a promoter. Yeah.
But that was one of the things that would happen in little towns. You know, you would hear about something like Desolation Center and you'd say, okay, well then I guess we're going to book this show in the middle of a cornfield, or rather Lubbock, Texas, in the middle of a cotton field, which is often what happened. Barns and sheds out of town became the place that you would go, and the same situation would happen. Here's your map to find the shed where this band is going to play. Good luck. And so watching this film becomes an exercise in, you know, your own not nostalgia, but your own, like, oh, they did this and it affected how we did our thing in another place. And so one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was, what feedback, because you were like you were involved in so many things. What feedback did you get, particularly if you were out on tour with a band? What did people tell you? How did they communicate with you? Did they write? Did they just talk to you at shows?
Occasionally, you would get a letter in the mail. But most of the time, people would just approach you.
Yeah.
You know, either at the venue, outside of the venue, as you're loading in or loading out, people would often offer their homes,
yeah,
and their floors to crash on. There was a lot of that.
Yeah.
You know, cutting costs any way possible and staying on the floor of a lot of these like punk rock squatter pads. I remember that after a while that could grow to be kind of tiresome because you've got the window of opportunity of maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
And you go to these homes and you've got a guy with a mohawk and a quart of beer that wants to party with you. And you're just like, I want to go to sleep. And they're like looking down at you and just look at the rock star from LA. Without realizing that we've literally got 4 hours of sleep here before we got to get up
and
drive,
drive
another 200 miles to the next show. So, but still, you know, I don't think I would have traded. I don't think I would trade any of those memories for anything. I learned a lot. And I also got to see this country in great detail.
Yeah.
It was almost like being, you know, joining the army. It was as close as I could come to doing that.
Yeah. Did you have any idea how influential the activities taking place here were making activity take place in other parts of the country?
Somewhat. It seemed to me to be a very underground kind of thing. It wasn't anything that mainstream culture was touching.
Right.
Mainstream press or media outlets were actually running news stories against this music.
Right.
That's also covered very well in Desolation Center.
Yeah.
Stewart actually went and licensed some of those clips. I remember at the time being very entertained by it.
Oh, yeah.
And I would make, before I even had a VHS, I would make audio cassettes of these sort of sensationalistic, journalistic hit pieces on the crazy punk rock movement coming for your kids from Little 11. And I would actually record that off the TV with a cassette recorder. I would make my little punk rock mixtapes, and I would use some of the dialogue as snippets between songs. Also, the same thing with like the punk rock episode of Quincy, the punk rock episode of Chips.
Chips, right.
You know, you just take sort of this, you know, dialogue and use it and utilize it in mixtapes very effectively.
That was the thing. The mainstream media had a version of this that they were selling to the rest of the country. And it was in shows like Quincy and Chips and Mama's Family. And who else had a punk episode of some mainstream television
network
show? Square Pegs. Square Pegs felt like it kind of lived in it a little bit. Like
Square Pegs was dabbling in the new wave.
Yeah.
And you know, basically the message was the new wave was safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this was sort of across the board. It was just sort of the default.
After school special called The Day My Kid Went Punk. I remember that. Yeah. But there was that definite sense of, you know, this is the thing that you should be afraid of, parents, at least until we realize that hip-hop is here and we have to make you afraid of that. And then we will ignore punk
and then
after that.
And then in the early 90s, punk rock will really break through in a way that would make all of these little hit pieces null and void.
Right, right. Now, the other thing that you said, you know, like mainstream culture wasn't touching this, it made information move very slowly.
Well, information moved a lot slower back then.
Yeah.
There was no 24-hour news cycle. There was no internet. There was no...
But without
the only really way that kids like us at the time could have communicated would have been through, you know, the U.S. mail or fanzines.
Yeah.
And fanzines played a very important role in the building and spreading of this culture. And it really, throughout the 80s, really did live underground, and I think created this sort of organic culture that really I don't think could have happened any other way. But of course, what really was going on is it just sort of laid the groundwork for what was to follow,
right,
in the following decade or decades. Really, it was going to be the influencer of music and culture and music festivals in the case of Desolation Center, predating Lollapalooza and Burning Man, and sort of predicting or setting up or sparking an idea for these events, but also happening in a very underground, ragtag kind of way.
Yeah. Now, a lot of times you hear from photographers and filmmakers that they often feel like they are standing sort of a bit outside their subjects, sort of quietly observing, but you were not. You were doing a lot of things all at once.
That's true.
Particularly in the early 80s, you were playing in bands, you were making a zine that people cared about, you were making films, you know.
Sort of a conflict of interest.
Well, I get the sense, like, you know, as a film critic, I watch a lot of documentaries. And you have, on one end, you have people like Frederick Wiseman, who are the definition of fly on the wall, you know, I'm detached. I will make a narrative or a statement in my editing, but otherwise, you know, I'm not in this. And then you.
Right.
You were the opposite.
Sort of the opposite. Yeah. Where I'm like so deeply involved in it, I'm going to present this to you. I'm not even going to tell you what to think. I'm just going to put you there, kind of thing.
Now, did you ever make a distinction between all the projects that you were working on, or did it all just feel like a natural part of waking up and living at any, you know, given moment? You'd be doing one of these activities.
A little bit of both, maybe. I mean, yeah. I think one thing really sort of led to another. It was great doing a fanzine at the time, because that got me in touch with a lot of musicians and was sort of the base of a lot of friendships at the time.
Right.
And also being a documentarian, whether I was shooting Super 8 film or taking 35 millimeter photos or what have you, it was a great sort of backdrop to document and learn how to do that. And it was a very rich kind of scene. So yeah, there was so much going on. And, you know, for me, it was very much a learning experience, all of it. Like, it was really sort of the best film school.
Right.
Without any sort of formal education. Learn by doing.
Yeah.
By trial and error, you know, a lot of errors ended up becoming things that sort of, you know, sort of help establish the gestalt of what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
the mistakes.
And mistakes were left in,
yes.
Which I found really, I guess where I'm going with this, there is a quality in the work that you've done that I've paid attention to over the years. And it's, you've never lost your sense of, you know, raw in the moment work. There's nothing, there's no reshoot. and I've...
Again, very economically, you know, based, because literally... Basically, 100% of what you're shooting is going to be in it,
right? And for people who watched it out in the world, that aesthetic became a bit of a secret handshake, because you knew that it was coming from someone who was like you. You knew it was coming from someone that you would have known if they lived in your town.
In comparison to, say, the media that was being fed to us, which was
Pretty in
Completely
Pink.
Ridiculous.
And I love Pretty in Pink, but it's right. That and Square Pegs are this culture filtered through something else. And
Square Pegs, funny enough, actually took dialogue out of my fanzine and put it onto their show.
That does not surprise me at all. That does not surprise me at all.
I remember at the time being so shocked by that and kind of excited.
Right. Right.
Because
because you're like 17.
When I try to get back into my teenage head at the time, it's not like a lot of stuff I think I would appreciate a lot more now as an adult, as you know, a 55-year-old who's had the benefit of experiencing longer periods of time.
Right.
And sort of growing through and growing up with all of this, being a part of it and whatnot. But at the time, I don't think I was really even that conscious that even what if I saw something like that, you know, Square Pegs actually taking dialogue out of my fanzine and putting it on their show, it wasn't like I felt like maybe how a young kid would feel now that's got, you know, 100,000 Instagram followers.
Right.
You know, I think what I mean to say is that it was pretty sort of humble about it at the time and almost sort of downplaying it. But then many years later realizing that, yeah, you were definitely a part of something that influenced
a
larger part of culture.
It was like this just sort of snowball that kept
growing. When you're a kid, you're just doing it. You're just in the moment. You're feeding off of the energy that you're seeing, and the energy that you're a part of is so sort of expansive and interesting anyways.
Yeah.
So.
And you don't know where it's going.
Not
because
at all.
I remember Smells Like Teen Spirit being sent to my friend Lynn, who had a late night show on the community radio station. And she said, hey, I got the new Nirvana record. And I was like, oh, cool. I'll come down and I'll hear that with you. And she played it for the first time. I said, wow, this is very catchy. Like, how famous can they become?
Right. At the time, there was really no indication that they were about to sell 14 million records and displace Michael Jackson from the top of the charts. That would have been a sort of lofty pipe dream at best in that era.
Yeah.
And of course, all the work I did in the 80s led me to a place where I was on the road with those guys.
Right.
Right before it happened.
Right.
And
which became 1991, the year punk broke.
Which was done in the same fashion as, say, the Slog movie was 10 years before it.
Right.
Which was literally a one-man show, one guy with a Super 8 camera, a finite amount of film out on the road, except this was a tour that went on. It was traveling throughout Europe, mostly a summer festival sort of tour. Some smaller club dates thrown in there in the mix. But, I think had I not done the work in the earlier 80s, that I wouldn't have been there.
Right.
And it was just sort of great timing to be there. And again, you're not even really aware of the history coming because you're not looking into the future.
You're not thinking of it like that at all. No.
You have no idea.
Now, stories?
I mean, you would have just been, it would have been beyond hyperbolic to anticipate anything other than, say, moving 100,000 units, which at the time was a massive success.
That would have been insane, right? Yeah.
Like, which was like the career that Sonic Youth had, or the Dead Kennedys had, or, you know, the sort of the cream of the crop of the bands in that era that were putting out records on independent labels. And really, if you could move that was, you were a,
you were a sellout.
Right. Yeah. And then the minute you signed to a major label, forget about it.
Right. Right. What in Desolation Center did you say to the camera that did not make it into the film that you wish had been in the film?
I did a couple different interviews for the film. The one that the piece that you see me in the movie was the joint interview that I did with Sonic Youth member Lee Ronaldo.
Right.
And that was shot in the living room of Stuart Sweezy's home out in South Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And we did another day of interviews at my house, at my home in West Hollywood. And a few other people were there that were interviewed. Some made the cut, some didn't, that was shot in the living room of my place. I remember that particular set of interviews was a little bit more raw and rambling, and probably why it didn't make it into the film.
Right.
But there was, as far as like remembering any sort of one instance about it, I can't really say. Mm-hmm. I think I did confess to being under the influence of psychedelic drugs at the event, of course. That sort of didn't even really need repeating or bearing repeating in the film. The sort of
they make it clear that pretty much the entire audience had dropped acid. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, sort of. And again, it wasn't like you felt like you were at some punk rock Woodstock.
Right.
At the time, you were just really looking for fun.
Yeah. I think about how, had I been able to place myself in that space, I would have thought my self-preservation instincts would have taken over, and I would have been like, I'm not doing this. I'm not going out to the middle of nowhere. I don't care what bands are playing that I want
to
see.
You would have to have stayed up all night, whether or not you...
Yeah.
You
Which you I could have done back then. I was still young, but it would have been the safety issues for me.
It was challenging. I mean, to be honest, not everyone there was under the influence, but you know, enough people were, and it definitely created a part, this energy that sort of differentiated the event from just a regular show.
Just a regular show, yeah. Where can listeners find you?
I'm pretty readily found on most social media platforms. Facebook, Instagram, David Markey. David Markey on Facebook, David J. Markey on Instagram. My website is wegotpowerfilms.com.
And you can buy things there.
I do have a store there. Yeah. And in addition to that, I have tons of sort of ephemera there, a lot of photo galleries, mm-hmm. a lot of media.
There's a great archive on We Got Power Films site, and it will provide you hours of entertainment if you're willing to go look through all of it, because I have done that. So the you also have a YouTube channel.
I do.
Yeah.
That's Dave Markey.
You know?
Sort of, you know, confusing between Dave, David.
Tell me about it. Yeah. my whole life. White. Yeah.
My birth name is David, but...
Yeah.
My whole life, everyone's called me Dave, as I'm sure you can relate.
My family to this day is all David, 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 and everyone I know is Dave. And when I show my family the book that I published, I say, you know, like that, I didn't self-release this. Someone else put this out, and the name on it is Dave. So you could maybe join in with the rest of the world and call me by that name. But
it's confusing.
They
for
want
me
what they want.
Because professionally, I've used both names. I really should have picked one, but other people pick them for you, don't they?
They do.
Oh, hi, I'm back.
It was a microphone issue.
We're having microphone issues, and it was like I was mostly going to be nodding during this conversation anyway. So,
Dave is still here.
Yes.
But before we move on with the reviews, thank you for being our guest.
Yes.
Again, thank you.
Greatly appreciated.
You are the friend and neighbor that we talk about far less than when we discuss Gary Cotti being on this show.
True.
We have many neighbors. You live exactly the same amount of distance away from us as he does. Where was I going with this? Yes,
no
Alonzo Duralde. Please discuss your personal connection to the documentary film Desolation Center.
Yeah, I got nothing. I spent the 80s listening to, you know, Scritti Politti and Wham UK. So
there was this moment.
No Spandau Ballet?
A little Spandau Ballet. You know, the radio hits, but like I didn't go into the deep cuts or anything.
There was a moment when you and I first started hanging out.
Uh-huh.
Where you were like, yeah, I'll go see bands with you. Like, and you tried for about the first 6 months.
Well, and to be fair, I did do college radio in the 1980s.
It's true, you did.
Completely clueless about
right.
stuff. But, you know, I've always been
Went to
lots of REM shows. Yeah. But I've always been a bit of a cake boy when it comes to indie rock. So, like, anything that was too harsh or hardcore or punkish, not really my thing.
REM were great champions of all of the music that I was involved with. So.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. I mean, like Mike Mills and Peter Buck were sort of famously, like, into, like, super obscure, you know, like, self-released bands. And
they knew what was up, and they were in the thick of it.
Yes.
I played you Swans today for the first time. How did you feel about that?
Whatever.
I keep my records to myself in this relationship.
Yes. It's one of the things that keeps us together.
which Swans album?
I played him Weakling, and I played it from the internet. I was like, here's a song. Yeah.
Not Cop or anything.
No. Yeah. The relationship rule that we have is, what?
Your mic is at a weird angle.
I know. I'm trying to get Dave if he wants to chime
in. All right.
Yeah. Is my voice okay?
It's
fine.
Yeah.
I boom plenty, don't I?
I suppose you do.
All right. So the, where was I going with this?
Our rule.
Oh, our rule is, if it's terrifically noisy, I play it when he's not home.
Or with headphones.
Or in the car, or with headphones. That's a nice rule. It keeps my lovely husband from having a headache.
You can listen to all the house music and Kylie Minogue you want in my presence.
In your presence, yes,
and
of
I'm
course.
Fine with that.
Yeah.
I've had similar experiences with past relationships of mine, so I could totally relate.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, Downton Abbey.
Ooh.
I've been doing a lot of talk in the past 30 minutes. Why don't you describe Alonzo Durell?
Sure.
What is Downton Abbey?
This movie is essentially season 7. Downton Abbey was a very, very popular ITV series played on PBS in the United States. Created by Julian Fellowes, who had previously written Robert Altman's Gosford Park. In fact, actually, Gosford Park inspired him to do Downton Abbey, the whole sort of upstairs, downstairs of it all. And so the show was set in one of the great manor houses and, you know, how the changing times of the 20th century affected both the aristocratic family that had lived there for centuries, but also their bustling staff. And the show begins in 1917 when the Titanic goes down, lasted for 6 seasons, was an enormous hit on both sides of the Atlantic. And now we return to Downton Abbey and it's 1927. And
everything's going down.
Everything is going down. King George V and his wife Mary are visiting Downton as part of their tour of Yorkshire. And so the whole house is abuzz. And various conspiracies are afoot from a mysterious visitor who may or may not be investigating the formerly revolutionary tendencies of former chauffeur, now son-in-law Tom Branson, to the staff at Downton who worry that they're not going to get to be involved in the King and Queen's visit because the royal staff is basically elbowing them out of the way.
The only one of the people on the staff who takes this as an opportunity to F off for a couple days and have a bit of a vacation is Thomas.
Right, and that's only because since he's not quite doing what is considered enough of to keep things rocking, Mary goes back to Carson, who is retired, and convinces him to to come back as head of household, as the butler, and Thomas
for how much money?
Yeah, that's never discussed.
No, this is like out of love and loyalty or what?
Yeah, you got me. But basically, yeah. So he comes back. So Thomas is like, "All right, fine. I'm gonna be elsewhere." So we get to go to a gay bar with Thomas, which is very exciting.
Okay, it's a gay barn is what it is.
Yeah, this is true. Like, yeah, it's hush hush and underground.
It's a little, it's like a secret doorway into a building and
in a warehouse. It's much like what you guys were just talking about.
Dancing. Desolation Center.
There's a band in a warehouse, you know, only there's more dancing in this one.
Dancing cheek to cheek.
Yes.
I just was really happy after years and years of this character, you know, being such a good, treacherous gay. Like, that's my favorite kind of fictional character, as I've said many times. I love a treacherous gay. But then he gets to have some happiness.
Yes.
And he gets to kiss a guy. And he gets to talk to another gay guy.
Yeah. It's very exciting. I don't know. You know, you reviewed this for the wrap, and as you point out, there's like 24 lead characters at this point that they have to try and wedge into the movie. I mean, I was thinking about, like, who's the protagonist of this film?
They all are.
Is it the house?
The house. Yeah, no, well, you know, well, I'll tell you who the protagonist of this film is.
The Dowager Countess?
The culture of feudalism and money
dominates
everyone's life. It is a
film. Class system is the protagonist.
It is about, and it's the hero. Like, it is a film about the dream of immense wealth, and also simultaneously the dream of adjacency to immense wealth.
Right.
Because depending on your temperament, you cast yourself in your fantasy. Like, this is fantasy football.
True.
You cast yourself
rotisserie
as,
league aristocracy.
Am I going to be Lord Grantham? Am I going to be
Mrs. Patmore?
Am I going to be class traitor chauffeur Tom Branson? Like, I'm really a rebel at heart, but you know what? I do look good in these suits. So, like, here I am. Oh, and your hottest daughter, I get to, marry her? Great. Or are you going to be a comfy, cozy Mr. Carson?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a slightly disgruntled Daisy.
Right.
You know, a pride in her work, you know, Mrs. Patmore. Like, who will you cast yourself as? Are you content with the idea of, you know, because this film makes you content with the idea of being a servant in a great house, and you get to be a pastry chef, and people pay you compliments. But as I said in my review, you live on a cot in a room the size of a prison cell,
right,
and that's your life. And you have to decide, you know what? That's a fantasy of a nice life.
Well, there has been a definite fantasy element throughout this. I mean, there was that whole, like, Mrs. Patmore at one point is losing her eyesight.
Yeah.
And they, like,
apparently she got it back.
Well, remember they pay for her to go to London and get the surgery and stuff?
They did.
And I'm thinking, like, they would have just fired her and gotten somebody else.
Yes,
and
so, it's terribly sad about your
she
eyes.
Would be sitting on a corner selling pencils somewhere. Like, there was not any kind of social, you know, like, safety net here. But, you know,
this is a dream of an aristocratic family.
Yes.
They are so kind and so generous and so progressive that nothing phases them. No amount of scandal or personal idiosyncrasy or, you know, trouble that comes along or sassy rudeness. Like, the way Daisy yells at Cora in season 6...
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot about
that. She would have been out on her butt.
Yeah.
And, but that's not what happens here.
No.
Everything is absorbed by the house.
So, if you are a fan of this show, this is like the biggest silver bowl of, like, clotted cream.
Yeah, yeah.
Trifle.
There's so many food metaphors and comparisons to be made. Because that's what we associate with this kind of British coziness.
Yes.
And that's exactly the function of this film, is coziness.
Cinematic crumpets.
Yeah. You are not to question it at all on any level. not particularly its politics or its, you know, happy ensconcement within the class system. You're not to do any of that. You are to enjoy the soap opera, visit with these characters that you've grown to love over the years, and
enjoy the lushness
of it. Look at that furniture.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll tell you something. You want an afternoon of gorgeous things to look at and beautiful outfits? This, and I will say it, the Goldfinch.
True. But this is a much more fun sit.
You're gonna be like it's gonna be like an afternoon of like vintage architectural digest.
Well, yeah. I don't know about your Twitter feed, but mine has been so many people like cosplaying this movie, like going to screenings where everybody is wearing like 20s outfits and tuxedos and stuff. Like
you want to be comfortable when you watch a movie, don't you?
The ArcLight even had like this whole sort of Downton interactive experience. Did you see that room that was set up at the top?
Yeah. Well, saw the dressing table and the lamp and all that.
There were people that went to a thing last night where they actually stood in that area and stuff. It wasn't just like roped off. Kind of. Yeah. It's like Comic-Con for viewers like you.
Thank you.
Yeah. But for as fan service, I ate it up. I had a great time. I enjoyed it in the same way that I enjoyed the Sex and the City movie. Which was that it was basically giving me another season of this thing, picking up where it had left off. And I couldn't help thinking also there are moments where you can tell the difference between like movie budget and TV budget, just in terms of like crane shots of the sun rising behind the Abbey and things like that.
Right.
It sort of reminded me like when they made the Mystery Science Theater movie, how the Satellite of Love set was suddenly much more
three-dimensional
and spacious and had all these things going on. Yeah. Like, you know, it's the same house. They can't make Downton itself any fancier. But, you know, if there's going to be a ball, there are a lot more people dancing and a much bigger orchestra and like much more like swoopy camera movements and stuff.
Here's my one complaint.
Okay.
Not enough snipey quips from Maggie Smith.
Well, there's never enough. There's a goodly amount.
I needed more. For a two-hour movie, she got in, what, three or four good ones?
Five or six.
Come on.
I will say this, though.
She's Iron Man. She needs to be... She needs to have the best line.
They have very shrewdly, speaking of Iron Man, laid out the groundwork for some sequels.
Oh, yeah.
Because we get some new characters here. We have Imelda Staunton as a cousin that we've never heard about before.
Guess who Imelda Staunton is married to?
Oh, God, you told me and I forgot.
Guess who she's married to?
Who is she married to?
Jim Carter, who plays Mr. Carson.
Well, there you go.
They have been married since 1983.
She's like, I want in on that action.
No, they've been together for like 40 years, 35 years.
That's amazing. Oh, yeah. Good for her. So we get Imelda Staunton as a distant relative. We get Tuppence
Middleton.
She just
wants to listen to him talk every day.
We get Tuppence Middleton.
Oh, Imelda.
As a lady's maid, we get, those are the two main ones, I guess.
Did you say Tuppence Middleton just now? Yeah. Well, ladies made with a secret.
Yes.
Yeah.
They've all got secrets. but anyways, they're setting up to where, because when Christy and I were talking about this on Breakfast All Day, I was like, you really can't tell this story after about World War II. Like by that point.
Oh, sure you can, because then you really get into the grit of how things change.
But I think that's going to be harder for people to watch as escapism, because by that point you would have the Crawleys really financially struggling and probably like donating the building to like the government to become a museum or whatever.
Yeah.
And nobody wants that.
People I want that. Here's what
you
thing
want
is,
that.
But because I want to see them take a fall, and I want to see. Because I don't care how nice they are. I want to see them taken down.
But that's not the fantasy that people are tuning in for.
But here it is. So see, the thing is that I disagree. I think that the house remains the same. The outfits remain impeccable. And they move forward in time.
Well, okay.
The human drama of these characters, they age because you already like them.
Yes.
You don't need opulence perfectly, you know, like you need to see them weather the decades.
I disagree. I disagree that the as many people would tune in for that as do for this. So, but let's just
they'd
say,
have me
but
in.
Let's just say that like 1950 is your end point here.
Right.
That's still a couple of decades to play with.
They really do. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
there could be a whole World War II movie.
Yes. They could turn the bottom floor into a hospital again.
Because like, no matter what, well, is it a spoiler to say who we're probably not going to get back for a sequel?
Let's not get into it.
Okay.
May I add a quick footnote here?
By yes. all means.
You mentioned the Goldfinch.
Yeah.
In relation to this film.
Yeah.
The production designer, K.K. Barrett, on that show is the drummer from the band The Screamers, who are featured in Desolation Center. K.K. Barrett's a very old friend of mine. He also was a Spike Jones guy for years.
Huh. Yeah.
Designed all of his films.
Everything.
So he did the Goldfinch.
He did the Goldfinch.
Well, tell him good
kudos.
There you go.
Boy, that is a good looking movie.
It's a small world, isn't it?
That is some primo apartment porn in that movie. But yeah, so Downton Abbey, and actually, you know, Christy had walked in having never seen a second of the show. Didn't even watch the little recappy thing that they showed me when I paid it, when I bought a ticket
so
to
did
it.
Our friend Robbie.
And and she loved it. So, you know, you don't
is
have.
Is she now going to go back and
I don't know if
get
she
in
is.
On all the Mr. Bates and
I wish
and Anna.
She's like
love in action.
As when somebody recommends a show to you or me, she was very. I'll put it on the list.
I'll put it on my to-do list.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yes,
who knows? Yes. But no, she had a great time. And yeah, if you're a fan of this show, God, you will.
And if you're not, and you know you're not, then you don't care.
Oh yeah, yeah. If you actively dislike the show, the movie's not going to win you over in any way.
Hey, guess what?
What?
Ovid. Ovid is a streaming service.
It sure is.
It's a streaming service that we super love.
It is.
It's a streaming service that we super love that we have in our own home.
We do.
And we can watch all sorts of things
mm-hmm.
on it. It is, for me, it is, and I say this in all sincerity, in spite of the fact that they're paying us to say it, the left hand to the Criterion Channel's right hand.
Sure.
I don't want to have a streaming life on that television without both of them. Like, if you've got Criterion, you also want Ovid.
Yes.
Because Ovid has what they don't.
The Ovid, deep cuts.
Ovid has, oh, it's not just deep cuts. It's like deep cuts that played 1 week at an art house in Los Angeles in New York and never went to any other city and then disappeared. So you get stuff like Peter Lennon's Rocky Road to Dublin, which is, I think, new this month. Which
yes.
That was a film that was, Peter Lennon had been in Paris for about 10 years working as a journalist. And he went back to his home city of Dublin, Ireland, and he decided to make a documentary about life there. Very much for me, I see these connections. It was 1967. I see a lot of Chronicle of a Summer in this film, where it's just everyday life, but it's more than that. It's about the trouble of Dublin as a place in that time, this time of great social change, where you know you've got. A church and state that don't know how to separate.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've got people living under the rule of England and a lot of, you know, unhappiness. And so it was the last film that screened at the Cannes Film Festival in 1968.
Yes.
Before they shut down the festival because the riots.
Because 1968
were taking place.
Yeah, no. So the film itself is a part of history. And they're also screening the making
Correct.
Of Rocky Road to Dublin, which has footage from that festival,
yeah.
including footage of both Godard and Truffaut.
So it was a controversial film at the time. And you really, I'd say this is a vital film to see.
It's something
that's absolutely necessary to see. There's also something new that I'm super excited about this month on Ovid. It's called Minute Bodies.
Yes.
And it's from Stuart Staples. Now, Stuart Staples
the Tinder
is the guy from Tinder Sticks who does all the scores for Claire Denis
right.
film. And what he has done is he's taken films from a naturalist documentarian, a British man named F. Perry Smith, and he sort of made an interpretive work
right.
out of these groundbreaking nature films that, again, something reminds me of something else. Reminds me of a non-aquatic Jean-Pierre Levé, who was the sort of underwater freaky nature film guy.
Right.
And so all this stuff, these two things, which are both really wonderful, are on Ovid yeah. this month.
You're not
there's
gonna
a
find
lot
it,
of new releases as well.
You're not going to find it elsewhere. You're going to find it on Ovid.
So,
as a special introductory offer
yeah,
for the Little Read Knife
that,
listeners,
read that bit right there.
Save 50% off the first 3 months of your subscription. Just head over to www.ovid.tv. That's www.ovid.tv. Sign up with the coupon code PODCAST, and you'll get ovid.tv for just $3.50 a month for 3 months. And that offer expires October 25th. So get on it.
Yeah. You really do want this.
So, Ad Astra, I want to thank you so much for mentioning the fact that that phrase appears in the Schoolhouse Rock song, My Hero Zero, which I've now had stuck in my head for like 2 weeks.
Great.
It's all your
fault. I'm really happy that I ruined you.
If anyone needs more math instruction, mister, it's you.
Oh, I'll tell you what should really happen to me. I should be put back into a first grade class with six-year-olds so that I can learn my numbers, because my inability to do any simple task involving numbers is, it used to concern me, but now I just think, that part of my brain just got wet somehow
in my infancy.
Maybe that was the part that got ruined by my mother smoking in 1964 when she was pregnant with me.
Maybe if we sat you down with a dyscalculia expert, you know, that might be a thing.
Do we know any? What do they charge?
They're out there. I don't know. Well, you don't want one of the cheap ones. You really want to spring for a good one.
One of the benefits of marriage is you pick someone who fills in your gaps. And you are, in effect, Rain Man. Because you can do all kinds of crazy things like divide in your head. How you can do this, I do not know.
Beats me.
But you can, and therefore, when I need help, I turn to you and I say, hey, help me do the thing with numbers. That thing that you can do. You're the horse that can count with its hooves in the dirt. Yeah.
Thanks.
That's what you are. You're Mr. Ed, but with counting.
Ad Astra.
So, Ad Astra. Dad Astra. Sad Astra.
I do admire that they figured out a way to make Brad Pitt shirtless in space. That took some doing.
Well, you gotta wash yourself sometimes, don't you?
I guess.
Do you get to wash yourself in space?
I guess they probably have like wet ones or something.
Do you get to like poop?
No, you don't poop. Of course you poop in space.
Well, where does it go?
Do they shoot
it out of the spit, out of the ship, into space?
I imagine that
Does your poop float around in
there
space?
There are probably like lengthy articles about this very thing. I'm going to guess it's something of like, have you ever seen those diaper things that people have in their house?
Like the lady who was the astronaut who wore the diaper as she drove from
place to place?
Remember that?
That's that lady? That's what that next Natalie Portman movie is about.
Is she the diaper lady?
They leave the diaper part out, though.
Everyone's very mad about that.
But she's playing the diaper lady.
How could you?
I know.
What's Natalie Portman's problem?
It's the director's fault, I think. But anyway, you know those diaper things that people have where like they take the used diaper and they put it in what looks like a hamper and they twist and it gets like encased in its own section of garbage bag and then you pull it out and it's like a candy necklace of poopy diapers. I imagine that pooping in space is something like that where it goes into something and it's airlocked and then you don't deal with it again until later. But I don't know.
I just Googled how do astronauts poop in space.
Okay.
And USA Today has a whole NASA.
I knew somebody would.
There's also a YouTube video.
Oh, good.
Explaining it. In fact, there are many articles about this.
The people have a right to know.
Business Insider, how NASA astronauts pee and poop.
Space Patrol.
Here are some weird facts about pooping in space on popsci.com.
I fear we've gotten off track.
Space Toilet has its own Wikipedia page. And after this movie, so will Space Baboon. okay, so here's what happens in this movie. Brad Pitt is an astronaut. He is summoned.
He's a real chill bro.
And he's a super chill bro. That's his superpower in the film as a human being. He can remain calm in the most terrifying Sandra Bullock in Gravity circumstances. And does so in the opening sequence.
His pulse never goes above 80.
In the opening sequence, he experiences something so frightening that I thought to myself as I watched it, if this is the whole movie, I'm walking out. If you are afraid of heights or flying or being in the air, don't be late for the movie. Maybe just don't go. It's really harrowing, but he is so, like, narrating his way down as he takes this immense fall, plummeting to his, certain doom. But, of course, there is no certain doom, because if so, there would not be a film. He's summoned to Space Jam Central, and they say to him... you remember your dad that abandoned you and disappeared?
And we all thought he was dead?
Well, maybe he's not dead. Maybe he's in space still. And maybe he's kind of...
doing a thing that is causing problems on the Earth?
Like serious Earth-destroying problems. Yeah. And we need someone who will go fix that situation.
Maybe find him and make him not do that thing.
Yeah. So Brad Pitt goes to space and he hunts for his father, played by Tommy Lee Jones.
Yes.
Now, of all the people that you could cast as space villain, is this not the most perfect casting?
Certainly. The idea of him also being father of Brad Pitt somewhat strains credulity, but you know.
How does that strain credulity?
Those are not two faces I put next to each other and think, the resemblances.
No, they show plenty of faces. They show plenty of imagery of young, hot Tommy Lee Jones in this film.
I suppose.
And if he had only married a blonde woman, you would be able to say, oh yeah, that could be your son.
Like circa when he was on The Doctors.
Oh yeah. Never forget, we all know in real life that Tommy Lee Jones is a terrible, terrible human being.
Mm.
This is documented not just by Chris O'Donnell from the Batman movies, but by Alonzo Duralde himself, co-host of this podcast, who has encountered Tommy Lee Jones.
We're not telling that story.
We don't need to tell the story again if you'd like to hear it. You just have to go back and listen to earlier episodes of this show. But it is...
But I
such
still,
great casting because I know these things. And I'm watching him going, oh, you're a bad man.
I still greatly admire him as an actor.
That's the thing.
Despite
he's
my
so great
personal encounters with him, I watch him in movies. I'm like, GD at Tommy Lee Jones. Why you got to be so good at this?
You're so good at everything. And while I'm watching the movie, I'm like, man, Tommy Lee Jones is the greatest. And then the movie's over and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, he's also a total a-hole.
Anyway, so this is the new James Gray movie.
And that means something here.
Yes. And he is a... I don't know if divisive is quite the word, but there are people who are way, way, way into him and what he does and how he does it.
Yes.
And I am not one of them.
You're not one of them. I am.
But I respect critics who do, and I get to
thank
some
you for
extent...
your respect.
What they see in it. I mean, I know you don't care about my respect, but you know what I'm saying. I'm not going, what? Are you insane? What? You know, it's not like somebody who's like a Tommy Wiseau tourist or something.
Right.
Like, I get what's going on here that appeals to people. It does not appeal to me. And
what do you think about this one?
I like it. I probably like it more than any other of his stories.
We haven't even had a chance to talk about it until right now on the mic.
Yeah, I like it more than I've liked anything he's made yet that I've seen. You might. Yeah. And I admittedly, I've not seen all of them. But I didn't. This is still, I think, a movie that I admire more than I love or even respond to. There's a lot of it that left me emotionally cool. But I certainly think the craft is exquisite. I loved looking at it. Hoyte von Hoytema shot the film. And,
right.
You know, the sound design is great. Brad Pitt is doing another amazing performance. You know, I think it's so often one of the biggest challenges for actors is not to go big and wild and crazy and, you know, Joaquin Phoenix size.
Right.
I think it's playing a character who is emotionally shut down and portraying that in a way where you're not giving a performance that is emotionally shut down. And I think that's what he's doing here. And I admire him treading that fine line because I've seen so many actors blow that in the past.
Right. I agree with you. It is gorgeous. And it's my favorite kind of gorgeous.
Rigorous.
And really, really quiet.
Yes.
It forces you to pay a kind of attention that mainstream films tend not to force you.
Well, you were talking about how movies are terrified of silence now.
Yes. Yeah.
There's always like music or effects or something. Yeah. Like they won't let you just be in a moment.
And you do get a few bursts of activity in this film.
Oh, absolutely.
But I was at the AMC Century City on Friday night in a packed theater. My least favorite kind of theater to be in. Mm-hmm. Strangers. To the left of me, to the right of me, to the front of me, to the back of me. I don't like that.
Not in the back of you. You were in the back row.
You know what I mean.
Okay, fine.
And a half hour trailers.
Which, you know what? I had a nice nap. during the trailers. Except for, you know, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which got me all choked up.
Oh, my God. That move, that trailer. I haven't seen the movie yet, but the trailer makes me almost cry. It's crazy.
I noticed a lot of audience fidgeting.
I bet.
People getting up multiple times.
Mm.
A couple walkouts. Mm. Some, you know, chatter. Chatter. What's going on? Why is he doing that? What's happening here? Like, it relies on you to keep up with a film that is not incredibly event-filled.
Right.
You are asked to pay attention to the shifting qualities of Brad Pitt's face.
It is more Solaris than Gravity.
Absolutely. Gravity is packed with incident.
Yeah.
Gravity throws you around so many corners and makes you panic during its entire running time. This is not that film.
No.
This is a film about a father and son who are as estranged as two human beings can be.
Literally.
And when the worst of it takes place, when the worst moment of that estrangement takes place, and you watch Brad Pitt react to it, for me, that was, you know, the crescendo of the of the film. But again, when I say crescendo, I mean something very quiet is taking place.
Right.
Someone says something, well, here's what I really think. And then someone else reacts without speaking.
And the movie also kind of takes his, like what you call his superpower, his preternatural sense of cool.
Yeah.
And also portrays how that makes him emotionally unavailable.
Right.
You know, we see a few sort of flashbacks of why his marriage to Liv Tyler has fallen apart. And so this quality that movies would normally unquestioningly present as this sort of macho coolness and unflappability, they're also delving into the fact that it has isolated him and it has made it his, it has made it impossible for other people to grow close. And obviously, where, how does that hook into the daddy stuff, you know?
Right.
I mean, there, there, I was reminded of Contact in a way, because right. you have somebody who was literally schlepping across the universe,
yes,
to like confront their father,
right,
you know,
right.
But told in a much different way, obviously.
Yeah, for sure.
The aesthetics are hugely different.
There are two sort of jolts in this film. One, yeah, involves the space baboons.
Yes.
And one involves Natasha Lyonne as her character from Russian Doll.
Basically, yeah. And it's like, it that comes and goes so fast. You're like, wait, what?
You're like, oh, there she is. She, and then she's like, hey, Brad Pitt, how's it going? What's your hurry? Like, you're wondering, is she going to be in the rest of the movie? Is she going to chatter the entire rest of the film? Are we shifting full gears here? And is this now going to become like a buddy comedy with Natasha Lyonne and Brad Pitt in space? Can it?
Would it, please? Alas, no.
Yeah.
But there is this great parade of character actors. You've got, yeah, like Ruth Negga and Kimberly Elise and Lisa Gay Hamilton and John, right, Ortiz. I did not recognize Lauren Dean.
Oh, I did.
Remember the Lauren Dean moment?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I did.
I was fully excited to see Kimberly Elise.
Yes.
Because when she popped up, I thought, oh, good, you're in a big movie. You deserve to be in a big movie. Yes. I mean, as much as anyone deserves
anything.
Like, I look at someone like her and I think, you should have had a better launching pad,
yeah,
with Beloved. Someone should have looked at you in that movie and said, oh, yeah,
her.
Start putting her in everything. And they didn't. She just kept working. She never stopped working.
But
she hasn't gotten her due.
There is yet a set of actresses where I think, if you're working for Tyler Perry, Hollywood has failed us all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, African-American actresses.
Who and Kathy Bates.
And Kathy Bates, who aren't getting the breaks they need.
Yeah.
They wind up in Tyler Perry movies, because, yeah, he'll take care of you.
Yeah, you're first on the call sheet.
Yeah. And you're loved.
Yeah.
Like, you're treated well. Like, you are...
appreciated.
You're appreciated in that moment. In a movie that's probably not going to be very good. However... Yes.
You're given an opportunity.
You're given these opportunities. Yeah.
We did not see Rambo Last Blood, but I do have to see it for Who Shot You, so I will talk about it.
I might go with you. I don't know.
I'm not going to push you on that one.
Listen,
Ad Astra got a lower cinema score than even Rambo Last Blood.
Well, here's why.
Because
audience knows what they want.
Right.
They want Rambo, and they want killings.
And a lot of the Ad Astra audience Gravity and not Solaris.
Wanted Gravity and not...
Yeah.
Which is what you get in Ad Astra. It's a, you know, it's a...
I think it's interesting that the ad campaign for the new Rambo movie features him wielding a knife. Notice the absence of his machine gun.
Oh, right.
In
right.
this era.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, no.
Absolutely. And I,
among the people who hate the new Rambo movie are the guy who wrote the novel First Blood. He's been tweeting about how he's embarrassed to be associated with it.
How many Rambo movies has there been?
Four or five now. Is this the fifth one?
Yeah.
Listen.
More Rambos than Rockies, or more Rockies than
Rambos? More Rockies than Rambos.
More Rockies than Rambos, yes. But the, that one that came out a few years ago. It was just a frenzied slaughter, like the whole movie.
In like... I forget what Burma is
all
called.
All I remember
now.
Is thinking, now this is the Rambo
you signed up for.
I signed up for. So I have a curiosity about this one, because apparently this one's super like MAGA-y.
Yeah, apparently so.
Which makes me, again, a little interested.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to buy the ticket.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, hell no.
No, yeah. I would want to just waltz in after, you know, buying a ticket to Downton Abbey.
Sure.
The Roy Cohn documentary.
Yes.
Which is what we're now going to talk about.
Yes. Where's My Roy Cohn? It is the third documentary in just a couple of years from Matt Tiernauer. who recently gave us Scotty, The Secret History of Hollywood and Studio 54.
Yes.
And this is one that is directly inspired by contemporary politics to the point that the title is a quote from Donald Trump, although it does not appear in the film itself.
Right.
But Trump was something of a protege of Roy Cohn's and recently was sort of wanting a new Roy Cohn in his life to sort of get him through, you know, one of various rough patches he's been in.
Yes.
But Roy Cohn is, you know, one of the monsters of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah.
He was a self-hating Jewish man, a self-hating gay man who made the lives of others miserable and was interested solely in power and how he could exploit it.
And was probably guilty of at least one manslaughter death.
Yes.
Yeah.
But ruined countless lives by being the lieutenant to Joe McCarthy during the HUAC hearings and the Army McCarthy hearings. Also was ferreting out what they then called homosexuals.
And perverts.
Perverts in the sex State perverts. Department in the 1950s. And then went on to
I want to reclaim that as an expression.
Perverts?
I'm a sex pervert.
Sex pervert seems redundant somehow.
Seems fun.
Like, I'm a sex pervert as opposed to a dessert pervert? Like, I don't know what else.
Oh, I'm also a dessert pervert.
You are a dessert pervert, yeah. Actually, yeah. Anyway, he then went on to represent a lot of mobsters and then finally got disbarred for being such a scumbag lowlife.
Right.
But not before helping put the Reagans in office. So, yeah, he's just the worst. And then he died of AIDS-related complications, denying all the way to his deathbed that he was either gay or had AIDS.
Right.
So, you're the worst, Roy Cohn, and here's a movie all about you.
What I think is really important about this film is the history lesson.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of people who remember him. We don't remember name.
He's a character in Angels in America, so he has that level of immortality.
Yes, how many people have seen Angels in America? Mm-hmm. Here's the problem. When you are hideously, notoriously bad, but still sort of a minor level name.
Behind-the-scenes guy.
A behind-the-scenes guy who exerted an astonishing amount of influence on people you do know.
Right.
Ronald Reagan,
yes.
Donald Trump. It's important to know that nasty monsters like Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan didn't come out of just nowhere.
They had a guy behind the
Are
guy.
You listening to this podcast for the first time? Are you shocked that I say that Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan are hideous monsters? Well, go back and listen to some earlier episodes, too, where you'll hear all about our politics.
Stop the presses. This gay couple doesn't like Donald Trump or Ronald Reagan.
We need that history lesson.
Yeah. No. It's
and
very
we
valuable.
Need it in this way, because particularly for queer audiences who don't remember the nasty, nasty, nasty bad old days.
Yes.
Of being queer.
Yes.
You know, the level of animosity toward the existence of queer people all the way up through, today. But, you know, like specifically...
The glee with which our lives were
destroyed.
Ruined.
Yeah. The 20th century post-war years were especially punitive for queer people. Before World War II, people just didn't talk about it. But no one was actively persecuting you. And as we discussed when we talked about the documentary, The Lavender Scare.
Right.
After World War II, when the Cold War began and the hunt for communists took hold, it also became a hunt for homosexuals.
Yes.
Of any stripe. And
the idea being that they were subject to blackmail, but it never occurred to anyone to like change society so that they could live openly. No, it was to demonize them as being part of the Red Menace.
Right. Like they deserved to be blackmailed. Yes.
P.S. The communists didn't like us either.
No, exactly. So, if I have any empathy for Roy Cohn's plight, and it was a plight, you know, you're not born this way. You're born queer, but you're not born a monster. Unless you have, like, some sort of, you know, psychological, you know, chip missing in your head.
Right.
He was made into this person. And what makes you into this person is a culture that wants you dead.
Here's the thing. He's and part of a generation that grew up in that. So
if you are of a mind to be a bit vindictive or mean or nasty, and clearly he was because his mother did that to him, apparently.
Yeah. I think he's missing the empathy chip.
He might be missing the empathy chip, but I've met a lot of people in my life who are missing the empathy chip, and they're not Roy Cohn's.
Right.
They are just disagreeable people that you want to avoid. He became a caricature of a monster. And so when I see him, I think, yeah, the world did this to you, and you spent your entire existence trying to get back at the world by any means you could. And you had a lot of means to do it.
You know who else grew up in that same generation under similar circumstances?
Who?
Charles Nelson Reiter. And he did not.
He was a delight from start to finish.
He was. So I don't buy. I mean, yes, Roy Cohn is certainly a product of.
I'm not saying any one factor turns you into this monster.
Right.
I'm saying that, you know, all other things being equal, he might have turned out just to be sort of a disagreeable lout.
True.
Yeah.
He would have just been an obnoxious straight guy as opposed to.
One of my favorite stories from the Martha Stewart show. She was doing a recipe with somebody one day, just stirring whatever. How the subject of Roy Cohn came up, I don't remember, but Martha Stewart was hosting some sort of dinner party in the 80s, and Roy Cohn was a guest, and he, like, threw his jacket or his briefcase or his shoes or something just haphazardly around the house, and Martha Stewart was like, just the worst, most rude guest I've ever had in my home. What an awful man he was.
I wish he'd been in the documentary. They needed that extra dollop. Of...
Wouldn't it have been the best, like, that's the anecdote from Martha Stewart? Well, he was quite rude, and he threw his jacket on the floor.
Yes. Like... I never invited him back. I was fascinated to learn that Barbara Walters is so chummy.
Lifelong friend. At least until he was disbarred, and then she shined him on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's this moment where, like, somebody talks about, you know, he would have this annual dinner for sort of, like, close friends, and this guy got invited one year, and it was right after the disbarment, and he shows up, and no one came. Like, all of his fancy la-di-da New York friends totally shined him on once he got disbarred, which is such a face on the crowd moment.
Yeah.
You know, where Lonesome Rhodes gives that big banquet for himself at the end and no one comes. Oh, good.
So anyway, if you want to be bummed out,
you'll learn things.
I learned things.
I thought I knew a lot about Roy Cohn, and I learned things.
Whoever the gay you hate the most is in life,
you'll have a new one.
You'll have a new one to hate more.
I'm in.
Yeah. It's currently playing in New York and Los Angeles and where else? Anywhere else?
Just New York, LA this weekend. It's expanding.
Yeah. So where's my Roy Cohn?
Yes.
Well, he's dead. That's what it is. Sorry.
Not sorry.
We are completely finished with this Pushing 90 Minutes podcast.
Yes.
I'd like to once again thank Dave Markey for coming to be our visitor and our Desolation Center OG. Because that's what you
are. My pleasure.
You lived it, man.
Fun watching you guys at work.
Fun. Find him all over the place, like he said before.
Yes.
Go to We Got Power Films, because, again, you can buy DVDs of cool stuff from the 80s, and you can look at all of these archives that are fascinating. If you are the kind of person that knows you like this stuff.
Yes. And 90s.
And 90s, and yes.
A little bit 2000s.
Yeah.
All right, then.
Yeah. Yes, the man keeps working.
Yeah. No question.
Why don't you talk about Patreon?
Hey, everybody. We have a Patreon. It's at patreon.com/linoleumknife, where we offer lots of stuff, most notably extra content. If you like this show, thanks. You might also like LKTV, a podcast of the television, or Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, or Linoleum Nights, where we talk about current events and trailers and other stuff. And
this week, it's all about bamboo toothbrushes.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
We're trying to diminish our plastic using footprint. But, you know, we also have stuff like t-shirts and enamel badges and coffee mugs and Christmas ornaments. You can get custom-made, personalized 20-minute podcasts on a topic of your choosing. You can participate in monthly club meetings where we all get together and watch a movie on Netflix and have a Google Hangout. You can subscribe for as low as $1 a month and get our daily LKRX recommendation of things and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a great thing. And right now we have a special promotion happening.
We do. I've got like two copies left. Originally I said I had five copies.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of lied because I actually bought seven copies with the intention of giving them to a couple friends. But those couple friends bought the thing already.
Oh, well then.
And here's the thing. Our friend, Karen Tonkson, who is a professor at USC.
Yes. Formerly of the Pop Rocket podcast, currently of the Waiting to Exhale podcast.
She wrote a book called Why Karen Carpenter Matters. And I bought a bunch of them. And if you join at the $16 a month level, or you upgrade to $16 a month from a level that you currently are already at, you get a copy of that book, and it's at least these first seven copies are signed.
Yes.
So email me at dlelandwhite1964. Leland is my middle name. dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. Tell me you want to join at 16 or upgrade to 16, and I will let you know if we still have those two copies of the book left. And if we don't, then you're still welcome to upgrade or join at 16.
We would love that.
You just won't get a book.
Yes.
But you get the book for free if you upgrade or join.
Yes. Yeah. So we hope you will. And we and if not, we hope you go buy the book because it's really terrific.
Yeah.
She knows her stuff and makes it fascinating. So, yeah, that's our time this week. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Dave Markey, for being here. Go yeah. check out what? Huh? You're looking at me. Like,
no, I'm asking you. You're going to run through the roll call.
I'm going to run through the roll call.
All right.
Yes.
All right.
Go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Our friends Bibbs and Whitney have a ton of stuff happening over at the Critically Acclaimed Network and also at Schmoes Know. And, of course, check out those lovely schmoes. Listen to Dennis, anyone with Dennis Hensley, All Things Cozy, The Comics Canon, Deck the Hallmark, Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us that 5-star review. We will read them on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Visit his stuff at blutopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We have quite a few letters backing up that we're going to be getting to next week, including some really great responses from trans listeners about the movie Adam. We wanted to get your feedback about that. If you are a trans listener and you have thoughts about Adam, let us know. We'll get to it on a future episode. linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back again next time with more.
I have a question.
About what?
Are you going to announce the thing you're doing in November?
Not yet.
Not yet? You're going to save that?
I'm waiting for them to officially announce it, and then I will announce it also.
But they have already announced it, haven't they?
Not my part of it.
Oh! Okay, well, that's a teaser.
Yes.
There's a thing happening.
Way to build in a cliffhanger, Dave.
There's right? a thing that's happening in November. Alonzo Duraldi is going to be doing this thing in November. At least that's what we hear. And so when that's fully announced and confirmed,
You'll hear about it on the socials, and we'll talk about it when we can talk about it. All right. Until next time.
Goodbye.